Good afternoon. Hello, my name is Megan Zimmerman, and I'd like to welcome you to Women on Wednesday. A few housekeeping items before we get started. Please turn off all your cell phones or pagers and stay in your seats quietly until 12:50. Also, if you could please fill out the evaluation sheet, as we do use this information for future programming. Our session today is titled Environmental Activism. With a focus on Earth Day 2009, our presenter will talk about the future with the new government administration directives on energy, the environment, and saving the planet. Having just received a Mother of Earth Award from the Women's Environmental Institute, she will highlight how environmental justice fits into the big picture and how it can be used to address the environmental deprivation occurring across the country, especially in urban neighborhoods. Our presenter today is Annie Young. She is a locally and nationally recognized orator who motivates listeners about environmental justice, social change, sustainable development, urban ecology issues, community building stories, and real life experiences. Over 35 years' experience in grassroots organizing and social change efforts have helped her form the basis of the messages she shares with her audiences. Her experiences help community members, leaders, and elected officials to discuss practical solutions in facing complex issues within our communities. We are very grateful to have her here with us today. Please join the Women's Center in welcoming Annie Young.
And are we going to have the lights? Are they going to be at least dimmed a little? That's perfect. Perfect. And is this too loud? It sounds like it's a little too loud, but it's okay. All right. Thank you. My name is Annie Young, and I'm actually here to recruit you to participate and get involved in the environmental movement. Probably many of you are already doing things to help save the planet, but that's what I talk about quite a bit. I am the environmental justice organizer in the Harrison neighborhood in near North Minneapolis, and I've been an environmental activist for almost 35 years, beginning with my longtime involvement in the Midwest food cooperative movement. I am a professional community organizer, as much as Sarah Palin doesn't like community organizers, and I have worked in grassroots citizen participation on many, many issues. I'm also an elected official in Minneapolis, now serving in my fifth term, four-year terms, as an at-large citywide commissioner on the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board. I ran on the plank of no spraying of chemicals and pesticides in the parks and a theme of flowers everywhere, which helped make me electable. Today, we're going to talk a lot about clean air, safe drinking water, toxic threats to communities are fighting. An environment, we need these things in an environment where it's safe to live, work, and play. We bring these things, they're taken for granted. They're taken as basic rights. Yet in thousands of communities around the nation, people's health, quality of life, and even their own very lives are being placed in jeopardy. Chemicals are released from smokestacks and pipes or that leach out of dumps into groundwater and are taking a daily toll on our health and well-being. What kinds of toxic threats are communities fighting? Health-threatening pollutants are discharged directly into the air and water by industrial operations like mining, oil drilling and refineries, pulp and paper mills, and chemical manufacturing. Accidental spills, fires, leaks, and broken pollution control equipment all add dramatically to the contamination of our environment. In addition to the direct discharge, household and hazardous wastes are dumped in landfills and lagoons and pumped into the Earth's subsurface by deep well injections. None of these methods are truly safe or contained. Incineration of waste releases thousands of tons of toxic substances into the air each year and also produces a highly toxic residual ash that must then be landfilled. Often polluting facilities like these are deliberately sited in communities in which most residents are people of color, low income, rural or inner city, elderly, and or without college educations. Industry deems these people least likely to resist or successfully defeat their permit applications. These are the same communities where very few people vote. We were just discussing politics. And a lot of these decisions are in places where people have not voted and don't elect the people that are making the decisions. By looking at these proposed facilities and blocking them or forcing them to adopt cleaner technologies with good neighbor agreements, community groups are not only protecting individual neighborhoods, but collectively force broad industrial sector to change their polluting practices. Only when it becomes too costly to pollute will industry consider alternatives like using less toxic chemicals, cleaner manufacturing processes, and reducing their waste. Now, somewhere in the intro, you said something about, I was going to talk a little bit about the current administration. And actually, I'm not, because I'm kind of holding my breath and waiting to see what they're going to do. But I know that Mr. Obama has, President Obama, has started looking at the whole carbon tax and different taxes on emissions. And I can say this. Lisa Jackson, who is the new EPA director, is fabulous. And already she has stopped the coal mining in the Appalachians and going to put all those companies, 150 to 200 of those companies, have their permits reviewed and refined. So they are moving forward, but it's still a little too early to tell how this is going to play out. I'm not always happy with some of the things that Mr. Obama's done in certain areas. But on environment and energy, the appointees and what I see happening, I have great, great hopes. So my background and where I started really working on environmental justice issues, was around a struggle we had in the Phillips neighborhood, which is where I live. I come from the grassroots movement of the people, human rights, women's rights, cooperatives, the sustainability movement, and I see actually a lot of uprising in the grassroots now starting to come about. I was talking with my friend on the way up here of, I was pretty alone for a long time, and when I remember even the mayor of Minneapolis introduced me just a year ago saying, when we talk later about this project I developed, a lot of people thought I was really crazy when I first talked about sustainability, and people thought, who is this person? And now green and sustainability are so overused, I can hardly stand to even hear them anymore. But so it's beyond vision. It's about really necessary, practical reality. I know that we are depleting our resources. It's obvious as you look at the prairie soil as it erodes away. It's obvious with deforestation of the rainforest and our own northern woods. We are losing the cleansers of our CO2 and the dioxins in the air. I've learned a lot this past 20, 35 years and often wonder what to do with this knowledge. So I spend time now teaching mostly inner city folks about green habits to protect themselves. Over the years, my work has centered around the Phillips neighborhood and grassroots community groups across the country. Looking at a broad range of environmental issues, including toxic waste, solid waste, air pollution, incinerators, medical waste, radioactive waste, pesticides, sewage, and industrial pollution. People of color in urban and rural areas are the most likely victims of industrial dumping, uranium mining, and dangerous waste and toxic facilities. So we had this garbage transfer station struggle. The county had built a downtown incinerator, and it had to be fed the garbage in order to produce the energy that they wanted it to do, so they proposed four transfer stations. And one of those was in the Phillips neighborhood at, I don't know how many of you know Minneapolis, but Hiawatha and Lake, in that general area was proposed. They took out 28 homes and five businesses and then moved forward. This was a very long struggle, almost 15 years. We had candlelight vigils. We used the mayor of Minneapolis actually helped us. We had a planning commission meeting, which never happens, but we convinced them to hold it out in our neighborhood where we had over 500 people attend, and elders and all kinds of people spoke who never really get that opportunity because they can't get downtown to City Hall. So when you come to the neighborhoods, it gave some, you know, impetus to the struggle. And a turning point that happened in this struggle was that a college student, a graduate student at the University of Minnesota, was actually studying racism. And for her master, or her PhD, she brought in a woman named Cynthia Hamilton from the University of California, Riverside. She's now in Rhode Island, but nevertheless. Cynthia was a lawyer and had fought hazardous incinerators, medical waste facilities in East Los Angeles, which they still haven't built because they keep moving it around and communities keep rising up. But Cynthia met with people from our community over dinner, and she asked us two things. She said, one, what will you do if you win? Well, most activists who have been in struggles for a long time don't often think about if you're going to win. And secondly, she said, so that she found that in working with groups that a lot of times it makes sense if you can turn a negative into a positive. And I have taken that statement and built this message and what I talk with people about now, because what I work on a lot is redevelopment. What do we do once we get these things cleaned up? What do we do if we win? We can win. And it helps to have a project or something that you will do. So we went to the county and we said, we want to build a green institute. And besides that, another neighbor had proposed a reuse center, and that the reuse center would take items and keep them from going to the landfill. We found out that 40% of landfills is construction materials. Many, many times those construction materials can be reused. So as the struggle went on, I mean, when Cynthia asked the question, what will you do with the land when you win? I mean, we all, you know, we had no idea. So as it went on, I had a vision. And the dream and the vision called for an alternative use of the land. The dream included a glass building, a pond, solar panels, a wind machine, and a deer at the pond. I turned that vision into this Legos model, and I carried this for 3-4 years. As a matter of fact, it's still in my house, and carried it with me everywhere as I proposed the Green Institute. So the Green Institute now exists. It's an outgrowth from the struggle with Hennepin County, and we have a 40-kilowatt solar arrays. We have a rooftop garden, and by the rooftop garden, and I haven't learned how to do PowerPoint very well, so I apologize. It's something about the pixels in the pictures. I have to go back to school and learn that. Now, at 15 years old, it's become one of the largest environmental organizations in the state, and it has over 200 environmentally friendly building features incorporated into what's called the Phillips Eco Enterprise Center. It has a lot of lease space. There's over 20 nonprofits in the building, of which most of them all have something to do with the environment or social change or progressive issues. So quickly, I usually ask people, what do you think environmental justice is? Now, I have it on the screen, so I'm going to go back, and you didn't see it. But do any of you know what the definition for environmental justice is, or what do you think it is? Anybody got a guess? All right. Well, since nobody has a guess, I guess I will tell you the answer, which is why you brought me here today. It's the right of every citizen in America to have clean air, clean water, and uncontaminated foods. Now, this was developed out of a summit that was held in Washington, D.C. in the early 90s, where over 500 communities came together, people from there, almost 1,000 people, who came and told their stories of what was happening in their communities. So they ended up developing the environmental justice principles and looking at, there's 17 principles, and looking at how we could work together, especially with the Environmental Protection Agency about defending these communities of color. So it's as basic as keeping the air we breathe clean and the water. And it's politically naughty as halting construction of incinerators in the inner city and growing food in a sustainable manner. As a matter of fact, there was another summit held in 2000, and they've actually changed uncontaminated foods now to basically about land use, and that every citizen has a right to be working on their land use issues. And no group of people, including a racial, ethnic, or socioeconomic group, should bear the disproportionate share of the negative environmental consequences resulting from industrial, municipal, or commercial operations, or the execution of federal, state, local, and tribal programs and policies. In the environmental justice movement, in many communities, it has been the women yelling, "Why are my kids sick? Why is this going on in my family?" And it's very important to look at shaping public policy about natural resources, economic development, and environmental protection. These are thorny questions. The thorny question is, who gets what, when, why, and how much? Why is all that coal mining happening in the Appalachians? Not only are they taking off mountaintops, but they took all the way to the jobs. Now, coal mining ain't a pretty job. But now there's no jobs when they're just coming in with these bulldozers and taking down the mountains. So a lot of this deprivation, when they promised us the transfer station, they said, oh, it'll bring jobs to Phillips Neighbor. And we said, how many jobs? 8. That's not jobs when you have thousands and thousands of people in your neighborhood. So today, historically, the poor, immigrants, minorities, and city dwellers have lived in polluted and less desirable areas. I have asthma, and I finally, after many, many years, was able to get a doctor to actually write that I have environmental asthma. In our neighborhood, we have a foundry. Foundries are one of the dirtiest businesses there is. We have 2 asphalt paving plants. We are surrounded by 3 freeways. And we also have lead, asbestos, arsenic, and all these other things happening in our neighborhood. So, and then now, it's ironic. I was born in L.A. and raised in Denver, and I left both places because of the smog. And if you ever drive into Minneapolis now, especially at 4 in the afternoon, it's very gray and brown and hazy. It's really very sad. So we have to remember also that the purpose of community organizing is to impact political power and gain political clout. And so for those efforts in the environmental justice movement, we've moved toward working and looking at justice and racism via the environmental issues. And for me, it's been really a strong base in my community organizing efforts. So what is environmental racism? Environmental racism in urban areas looks at housing patterns, street and highway configurations, commercial development, exposure to environmental toxins, and the location of municipal landfills, incinerators, and hazardous waste facilities. Environmental racism is a combination of prejudice and the power to implement decisions and policies that defend, protect, and enhance the social position of whites at the expense of people of color. Environmental racism has turned many African Americans, Hispanic, and Native American communities into toxic wastelands. Former United Church of Christ Head of Commission Study on Racism in America, Benjamin Chavez, states, "Environmental racism is enforced and maintained by legal, cultural, religious, educational, economic, political, environmental, and military institutions. Race combines with other factors, including class, and continues to be an important variable in explaining the social spatial layout of urban areas, including these patterns, which I pointed out. Environmental problems such as pollution discharges to the air and water, noise, and vibrations often are segregated from residential areas because of the public good. Zoning often has been used as a protectionist device to ensure a place for everything and everything in its place. Exclusionary zoning practices have concentrated in what we call LULUs, locally unwanted land uses in minority neighborhoods. And why do so many communities get these waste facilities and others do not? Political power and economic clout still are factors that influence the land use distribution of residential amenities and often determines who gets what and where. Just a couple of examples. The first lawsuit to argue civil rights in the siting of a waste landfill was filed in 1979 in Houston. The plaintiffs were residents from a black middle-income Houston subdivision who challenged the placement of a municipal landfill in their neighborhood. The Federal Center for Disease Control has determined that lead poisoning endangers the health of some 8 million inner-city children, largely African-American and Hispanic. Some 17% of all American children have elevated lead levels in their blood. Even more are now carrying inhalers as asthma attacks them. However, for African-American children in poverty, the rate is 55%. The California Rural Legal Assistance, representing Kettleman City, California, filed a class action lawsuit against Waste Management, Inc. in an attempt to block a hazardous waste incinerator. Most of those residents, 1,100 of them, are mostly Hispanic farm workers. And I could go on and on. And right now, some of the most recent ones are in Georgetown, Ohio. They're fighting a landfill expansion that comes within reach of an elementary and high school. There's a debate opening for a waste and sewer plant in Boston, right in the middle of the city, and a federal designation for low-income communities that prepare this, get this disproportionate thing, so they're fighting that. And then the whole access to clean air laws are being challenged by many, many cities across the country. And we in the environmental justice movement want to thank Paul Wellstone. Paul Wellstone really believed that politics is not about big money or power. It's about the improvement of people's lives. I had the privilege of working with Paul's scheduler on his first campaign, which we never thought he'd win, of course. I like being for the underdog. I'm always for the underdog. So it's really, really exciting when somebody wins. But he helped us by pulling forth a federal government record and Bill 1841, about environmental justice, and this ended up making it into the congressional record and onto the floor of Congress, asserting the rights of Americans about living in safe neighborhoods and communities. And so we're able to use that legislation. And one of the things that he said in his remarks on the congressional floor was, if we can give people the power to fight for environmental justice, they can win. I've seen it happen in the Phillips neighborhood in Minnesota. This community in South Central Minneapolis is the poorest and most culturally diverse neighborhood in my home state. When plans were made for putting a garbage transfer station in the area, the Native African, European, and Asian Americans living together there joined forces to stop the project. Now the Phillips community has access to a valuable piece of land in the heart of the city, where they plan to form and build the Green Institute. The goal of the Institute is to bring well-paying, environmentally friendly jobs to the neighborhood by fostering clean, green technologies and training youth to give them skills in recycling, energy efficiency, sustainable energy production, and reducing the use of toxins in manufacturing. We cannot ignore environmental justice any longer. It's been 20 years since the first study documents the fact that the poor minorities have to swallow a larger slice of the pollution pie. The environmental justice movement deserves our attention now. So we thank Paul forever and ever about that. And this is what some of it looks like in some communities. And the EPA has a toxic release inventory database. You can go on the computer now and find anything just about that you want about your community and what kind of toxic chemicals are being manufactured and what's being put into the environment. And this is an interesting fact, is that since World War II, 83,000, and now it's much more than that, this is probably a five-year-old statistic, 83,000 chemicals have been produced since then. Here's the story. 10% of those have been tested on animals. Of that amount, less than 1% have been tested on humans. And you notice the little picture here? One of the worst products for chemicals are cosmetics. And I really ask the women in the audience to really look at what you're using and be really, really careful, because especially hair dyes are really, really awful. And I have beautiful nails. My nails have flowers at the moment, but I don't use any other chemicals except on my nails. I've tried using the stuff that's free of animal products, and I actually don't really like it very much. So most of the time I leave my nails even free because it's not good. But if people use those fake nails, I just was reading Farrah Fawcett has nail cancer, and it's from fake nails. So be careful if you're going to use any of that. So very quickly, where does it all come from? We have air pollution, and it comes from, and I did this wrong, I should have changed the colors, obviously, but it's from factories, it's from cars, it's from incinerators. You've heard me talking about that. And knowing where your water comes from, it's really important. Now, one of the things I get off on is talking about bottled water. Not only is most bottled water tap water, they lie. This is all lies about the water. In Minneapolis, we have spent millions of dollars on a new water treatment facility. So the water is supposedly very clean. But the worst part about bottled water, besides the lies from Coca-Cola and Pepsi and Nestle's, I believe, is the fact of where do all those bottles go? And they're being put in keels. Do you know what a keel is? A keel is probably as big as this room that gets put out on a ship and put down in the ocean. There are mountains and mountains of plastic bottles that nothing can be done with. So I really beg people to do that. Then you want to question where your food comes from. Your food comes from, hopefully, a farm. Hopefully, a local farm here in Minnesota. Because otherwise, if it comes from somewhere else, like people that eat strawberries in January, come from South America and places where it's warm, but they get trucked in. And so the fossil fuels and the transportation to get here, and a lot of times they have a lot of vegetables and fruits have chemicals sprayed on them. And then it takes 2 or 3 days or 4 days on the truck to get here or air freight. And then before it ever gets on your shelf, it's a week, 10 days before from the orchard before it ever gets to your table, to the grocery bag. So, of course, I really encourage people to think local, think organic. There's now community-supported agriculture farms and a variety of places. And, of course, as Michelle Obama has done, I would recommend everybody grow your own garden. Now, I can say that to college students. It's a little tough and rugged. But you someday will be in a place where you will be able to have a garden. And everybody can garden. As much as you think it might be weird, you can garden. So this is where I work now, in the Harrison neighborhood. And in the Harrison neighborhood, I came there because there were 18 contaminated sites. It's a mixed-use neighborhood with some industrial. And so Leaf Brothers here was an industrial dry cleaners, linens, rug mats, restaurant stuff. And they used lots and lots of chemicals, which leached into the air. They were an 85-year-old company that had never had an air permit. So we made them get an air permit, went to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, went through public hearings, went through a whole 2.5-year process in order for them to get regulated. And so with that, they also changed a lot of their scrubbers and brushes and emission stuff to the tune of $1.5 million. And then what did they do? They sold out to a larger company. That company has moved. It's now an empty building. But we did win. Warden Oil Company, over way over on the right, was a 100-year-old company that had spilled oil everywhere. There's railroad car lines through here, so a lot of these products went in and out by railroad. And so we had to clean that up. Actually, the county helped clean it up, and it's now ready for residential development. We have Pioneer Paper Company, which is what's in the middle, and they still use the railroad links, and they move tons and tons of paper off to recycling plants, and they have lots and lots of trucks still in the neighborhood. Chemmart was another company which closed, and they distributed a variety of chemicals for industrial use, and this land is in the process of being remediated and doing brownfields remediation. And last but not least, which you can't see the picture very well, but down below is the scrap metal processors. And we managed to get them to move out of the neighborhood. And they have left behind tons of scrap still to be cleaned up. We're working on that for future development efforts. And there were 2 abandoned gas stations. And our mission was to get rid of and remove the 2 abandoned gas stations by raising public awareness. We had what's called a design charrette using the architectural department. And at that, somebody said, well, why aren't we having sit-ins and rallies and things? Let's do a happy hour up there. But we did. We started a happy hour thing on Tuesdays and Thursdays at 5 o'clock from 5 to 7. We would go hang out on the corner. And to bring our economic environmental change to the corner of Penn and Glenwood Avenues and another gas station at Girard and Glenwood. It had become a drug hangout. There were guns. There were gangs. I mean, it was really awful. And the owner is, have you ever heard of Bobby and Steve's Auto World? Well, the owner's Bobby Williams. Bobby Williams also happens to be a city council member in Columbia Heights. And he has a gas station just 6 blocks from these gas stations in the Bryn Mawr neighborhood where they kept that gas station and took out these 2. And so not only did we have happy hour, but we got thousands and thousands of signatures on petitions. We surveyed folks about future possibilities. We had press conferences. We actually made it onto CARE 11. And the day we did get the city to take the gas station out. And we did win this struggle. And we have a video from it being on CARE 11. And it was really quite the story. So there were television articles, newspaper articles. I mean, I pulled out every plug that I've ever known. But more importantly was the community that came together. And out of that now, a young woman has bought that land, and we actually are taking that negative, and out of that has come the possibility of a food co-op and putting a food co-op on that corner. We're looking at some other sites in the neighborhood also, but that's one of them. Environmental Justice Advocates of Minnesota is an environmental organization set up by Congressman Keith Ellison and myself to look at environmental issues across the state of Minnesota. And EJAM has helped look at asbestos and creosote issues up in Gas Lake, Minnesota. We've helped fight the placement of a tire burning plant in Preston, Minnesota. We've helped immigrant farm workers fight issues around the chemicals and housing issues in Faribault. And we were successful at getting Xcel to convert its coal plant on the river in northeast Minneapolis to natural gas. And now our current activities, we're putting energy into HIRE, which higher is an outgrowth of what the Obama administration is pushing right now, which is called green jobs. And the green jobs occurring right now include weatherization, energy audits, a variety of construction and building trades jobs. HIRE stands for health, infrastructure, and renewable energy. And so, leading up to Earth Day, which is next Wednesday, I have just some points of very quickly here as I wrap up of what you can do to help save the planet. First of all, you can turn off the lights. Now, most of these schools, I think, are getting to have an automatic things when rooms are empty. But even in your dorms or whatever, wherever you're living, I know most of you probably don't live on campus anymore either. I don't know. I can't keep track, but it doesn't seem that that's how it happens. Eat more vegetables, as we said, because of the trucking issues. Use greener cleaners. As many as a third of Americans have an adverse reaction to common household chemicals. Safer products can save you money, too. While furniture polish will set you back about $4, cleaning with 1/4 cup of distilled white vinegar and a few drops of olive oil costs mere cents. Many retailers provide in-store for your recycling, your cell phones, and different clothing, toys, computers can go to shelters, rescue places. And though donations, you not only relieve, through these donations, you not only relieve pressure on landfills, but you're contributing directly to your community. Some more things that you can do quickly, spend more time outdoors. One of the things that's happening to children today in our society is they aren't going outdoors. These kids are on those video games forever and ever, and it's very sad because watching ants crawl is a very interesting thing, trying to figure out how they make their little ant colonies. And it is good exercise. It motivates you to have fresh air. So you should always try to get off those computers, get those earphones out of your ears, and go outside and play. Just bring your own bag to the grocery store. Even though paper is slightly better than plastic, the best is for you to just bring a reusable bag. And to look at green products and adapt to more sustainable ways if you can, because it will help cut energy. And saving the earth starts very early. Children taught their parents about recycling. Most children, which you all were, taught your parents about computers. So things start at a very young age and are very necessary. So things that you can do is to help work in the community. You can go out to the forest. You can work with, recycling cleanup efforts. There's, clean up the beaches, clean up litter. There's just many, many things that you can do to work with community groups. So I thank you for listening and learning today, learning about healthy environment and vibrant communities. And I thank you very much. So I hear I'm supposed to now do some question and answers. So any questions out there?
What do you say to people that say green don't clean, as far as cleaning products and things like that? How do you combat that?
I combat it by, I make this product. I used to be the environmental coordinator at the Women's Cancer Resource Center for several years. And we give out a product called the Alice's Wonder Spray, which is borax, vinegar, a touch of dish soap, hot water. It's in a spray bottle. And I can take that spray bottle and show anybody what happens. It is absolutely amazing. And the thing is I have oftentimes taken a bunch of them with me when I speak and hand them out, especially in the African-American community, because there are still many, many people that use bleach when they're cleaning the toilets, their bathroom. Bleach is can make people very, very sick. Your nose starts running, your eyes get red, and you don't know what's going on. And people don't relate to the fact that it's making them sick. It's one of those things about you have to use it to know. Our grandmothers used to clean windows with newspaper because for some reason that lead in the newsprint could pull the grime off your windows. Vinegar is supposedly the best thing that there is. You put some vinegar in your bucket of water for mopping the floors. So, you know, when people say that, I just say, well, you need to try it. And if you're not going to try, well, usually there's not much I can do. It's just about the same thing, Gene, as I say about politics. When somebody starts complaining about government or they're just not doing enough or they're really screwing things up, and I say, did you vote? If people haven't voted, I won't even bother talking to them because you don't have a place to complain. So I would kind of use the same analogy as, you need to try. Have you ever tried? Have you ever tried using vinegar and water on something? Any other questions? Hello? Yes?
Amy, you talked about you've been involved in environmental justice work for 35 years, right?
No, EJ Works only been, I've been doing environmental work forever. Right. I mean, just living off the land and growing food and a variety of things. The environmental justice movement really is only about 20 years old.
What led you to that?
The Phillips, the transfer station struggle.
Okay, that particular thing.
Yes. Yeah, I didn't know.
Did you make a connection before then to your health? I mean, was that one? No. Okay.
No. Okay. No, it all came then. And what was interesting is at that time, is when we realized with the, about the foundry and the asphalt plants and everything. And I live on this little street called Longfellow, and there's only two blocks to Longfellow. We had two kids that died from leukemia. Now, the problem is with this whole being sick from the environment, doctors won't put it down because you don't know what it really is. And because, as we were saying, there's so many chemicals, they don't know which chemical it is. They don't really know if it's the air, if it's something you drank or whatever. So you can't get doctors to prove, but I'm going to tell you, from my work at the Women's Environmental Institute, that Women's Cancer Resource Center, I get them mixed up. Chemicals are what is creating cancer. I'm convinced that, I mean, I've had people come up to me and say, you know, my sister just got diarrhea. And I said, well, probably the water or the air or her food. I mean, I really believe that it is our water, our air, our food that is making people sick. But it is new. It is a new part. And what we do is we say it's kind of the new civil rights movement. The civil rights movement was in the 60s, mid-60s. And this now is the new battle for civil rights and racism and fighting racism. Anybody else? I think some of you probably have to get to class or get outside, or it's a gorgeous day. But thank you very much for coming, and thank you for having me.